This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century American history guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century American history guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, history guy of the 20th century and beyond. We're talking today about the history of outsiders in America. How have our attitudes and policies towards them changed over the years? I recently put that question to someone who should know.
My name is Stanton Braverman. I have a law office in Charlottesville, Virginia, and a primary law office in Arlington, Virginia. I've been practicing immigration law since 1972.
Now, at the start of today's show, May Nye said that the turning point in the history of immigration was the early 1920s, when the federal government created an extensive quota system to keep out so-called undesirables. But as far as Stan Braverman is concerned, there's another much more recent moment when life got a whole lot more complicated for new arrivals to the United States.
The turning point really came in 1999 with major changes in the immigration law. The lawyers refer to it as IRA-IRA, the Immigration Law Reform Act of Immigration Assistance. I don't know, the actual names of the acronyms always lose me, but everybody calls it IRA-IRA. And that was a significant change in the law that really made, in many cases, getting permanent residence literally impossible. One good example of that would be with Mexicans. The law said if you've ever been deported and come back after being deported, forget getting a green card. Just forget it.
But a lot of Americans say that's great. That's one less illegal immigrant.
No, because they come back. They're back. And on that particular point, let me tell you, there's particularly here in Virginia, a lot of American women have married Mexicans living out in the countryside who have been deported. Most Mexicans have been deported at least once over the years. So that law that says they can't get a green card because they've been deported and they've come back probably applies to 75-80% of them. So they get married, they have kids. The guy can't get a green card. So the wife goes on welfare. She stays right on welfare the rest of her life.
You're saying, where does that leave us?
And he's working illegally for some farmer someplace. And who pays? We pay.
You've been at this for 35 years, and even though my fellow guys, Ed and Peter, don't think anything that happened after the 19th century is history, I think 35 years is a pretty long time. Can you tell me how your practice has changed over those 35 years?
It has changed immensely. We started out, it was just a real fun practice. Everybody in it was fun to deal with. The Immigration Service was fun to deal with. The visa quotas were wide open.
Well, you don't give the impression that it's a lot of fun today.
No.
So what happened between those fun, loving, wild and wacky times when you started in the early 70s and today's immigration law scene?
The government, the public has become quite a bit hostile to immigration. The laws have been changed dramatically. We've got three times more questions we have to ask the client regarding whether or not he's eligible for immigration. It has gotten so complicated. I've been used as an expert witness on various types of immigration cases and other cases revolving immigrants. And it amazes me when you go into state courts and you say, I'm an immigration attorney. The judges look at you with amazement, like, wow, you have figured out the most complicated area of law.
You've talked about the hostility of people towards immigration, the attitude changing. Do you encounter much hostility when you tell people you're an immigration lawyer?
No. Actually, my problem with being an immigration lawyer is everybody comes to me and people that are hostile to immigration also have illegal aliens in their family. But being an immigration lawyer can almost be a curse because wherever you go, somebody's coming up to you. Oh, Mr. Braverman, I have a question regarding my ear.
Now that you mention it, Mr. Braverman, I have a cousin.
I went up to Canada. My wife went out and bought a house up in a little town called St. Andrews in New Brunswick. I figured, okay, I'll go up there for the summer and nobody will come knocking at my door up there. And sure enough, the Canadians come knocking at my door. I got a kid that's working illegally in Arizona. I have a kid here that wants to go to school at UCLA. They're chasing me down. So wherever you go, it's sort of like almost a curse.
Well, I'm really delighted that we were able to chase you down, Mr. Braverman. I want to thank you for spending all this time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Stanton Braverman is an attorney with the law firm of Braverman & Lynn in Washington, D.C. and Charlottesville, Virginia. Guys, That man was one beleaguered lawyer.
It is not easy
to be an immigration lawyer, at least if you're Stan Braverman.
Yeah, that's a real personal sort of canary in the mineshaft, isn't it? I'm mixing my metaphors. But the pain that he feels now, the demands and the hostility he feels, this is not just a debate. This is human lives are being impacted in this.
Well, typically I see it all through a cheerful rose-colored lens.
Good.
I love the idea of immigration lawyer, that you have people here who are not citizens, and yet American legal system will try to give them a fair shot. You know, I mean, you can imagine lots of countries where that would not be the case.
No, I think it's important what you're saying, Ed, is that it's still there, that reflex to reach out the helping hand, and that the legal system is amenable to these kinds of claims. But it's just getting harder to do that job, and it's a chilling thing to hear.
Well, just thank goodness he keeps working at it despite his fatigue.
And thank goodness we keep getting those phone calls. Peter, who's our next victim?
We got Joanna, and she's calling us from Washington, D.C. Joanna, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. I'm very excited to speak with all of you. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to the notion or idea that America is a nation of immigrants.
Yeah.
And this is seen as, you know, a fundamental part of our national identity. We're open, tolerant, diverse. At the same time, we've struggled with nativism, xenophobia, strong anti-immigrant sentiment. And I was just wondering if you could talk about how this positive narrative of the U.S. as a nation of immigrants came about. Has it always been part of American political rhetoric and the sort of historical narrative of the U.S., or is it more of a recent branding of the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question for Brian, Joanna. I'm so glad you asked it, because I think this idea of nation of immigrants and hyphenate Americans is a 20th century phenomenon.
Yeah, I think it is, too. Although, I thought you were going to take it, Peter, because you actually know about the early history of the United States.
I think notions that Americans shared common principles was one of the first great ideas, and it did cover immigrants. But there was also a darker side to this notion of what an American was in the antebellum period.
Get to the antebellum period, I don't like, you know, sort of letting your pristine founding era off the hook.
When everything was really good, yeah.
Exactly. Didn't Benjamin Franklin have pretty serious reservations about what immigrants there were here?
Oh, there's no question. There was anti-German nativism. He talked about Palatine Boers spreading over Pennsylvania. Everywhere you went, people were speaking German. It's a lot like the talk about Spanish-speaking today and Hispanics. Joanne, I think that the idea of a nation of immigrants is a public relations reaction to anti-immigrant feeling.
Ah, Peter, you stole what I was going to say.
So, I mean, you agree with that, Brian?
Absolutely. But I want to hear from Joanna. I want to hear why she's interested in this question. Is she an immigrant?
Or why she was interested in it.
Well, I would agree. I definitely think that it's more of a PR stunt, and the people who speak of it are usually the political leaders trying to get some use out of the phrase. But one of the reasons I was really interested in this question is because I study a lot about European immigration issues.
Uh-huh.
And it's really interesting to see either scholars or academics or policymakers in Europe talk about this idealized version of the U.S. as being a perfect melting pot. We know how to integrate all of our immigrants. We're extremely fluid and intolerant.
So, Joanna, is that still the case? European leaders, as we speak, view the United States as a model?
Well, by comparison, of course we're the model. I mean, can you imagine France being called a nation of immigrants?
So guys, what we're saying cumulatively is that Europeans are reacting to what in essence is American propaganda developed in reaction to the strong nativist resistance to immigration in the early 20th century.
No, I would add something to it. I think there has been an element of propaganda and self-conscious Americanism, but I think it's had an effect. I mean, I think it's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent. We don't want to glamorize it. We know there have been a lot of rough spots in American history, but it's part of our creed, you might say.
I can't think of another nation that has admitted with varying degrees of welcome people from a broader range of other countries over a longer period of time.
Right. So we shouldn't be, and I'm talking to myself now.
Yeah.
We shouldn't mistake those counterpuntal thrusts of restriction.
Oh, nice.
For what is, in fact, something rather unique in the last 200 or 300 years. And that's a relatively open, accepting attitude towards immigrants, if you take the really long view. I've learned a lot from this call. You should call
Joanna,
more often,
thank you,
Joanna.
For calling.
Yeah, I've learned a lot as well.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Joanna.
Bye-bye, Joanna.
Bye-bye.
All you continentals of Asia, Africa, Europe, Australia, indifferent of place. All you on the numberless islands of the archipelagos of the sea. All you of centuries hence when you listen to me. All you each and everywhere whom I specify not, but include just the same. Health to you. Goodwill to you all, from me and from America sent. Each of us is inevitable. Each of us is limitless. Each of us with his or her right upon the earth. Each of us allowed the eternal purports of the earth. Each of us here as divinely as any is here. Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, 1855.
Walt from Brooklyn, New York. Thank you, Walt.
We have time for one more call before we sign off today. Peter, who's it going to be?
It's going to be Bill from Oak Hill, Virginia. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you, gentlemen. Now, I was curious regarding illegal aliens and where we are today versus, well, what happened 300 years ago. You know, there was a time when some guys showed up on the shore in these great big boats, and they looked kind of like us, but a little bit different. And of course, those aliens were us. We invaded America, and how did the Indians handle that? And did they have any idea we would mess them up so much? And is that what possibly has us worried today?
Great, great question. You know, there's not one single Indian response, certainly, to the alien invasion. And you're quite right that that's what it was. But Indians didn't have a modern Western notion of race. As far as Indians were concerned, white settlers could be useful to them in terms of offering military and commercial opportunities. There wasn't any sense of overwhelming threat, really, until the 18th century, and as it became clear that Indian populations were being decimated and settlements were moving far to the west.
18th century, Peter. But how do you explain King Philip's War?
King Philip, locally, certainly there are a lot of examples of conflict. But I'm talking about a kind of a broad notion among Indians that all whites were a threat. That kind of construction, you might say, or idea.
I see.
Of race in that global sense. I think that's really an 18th century development.
Was there any sense, I'll ask you, Bill, or Peter, or Ed, I mean, was there any sense of the early white settlers arriving feeling like aliens and any kind of deference to the land that they were arriving in? That's just a concept that didn't compute.
Back in the inception of these meetings, neither party had any idea the other existed.
Well, it strikes me that by the time the English arrived in British North America, both sides knew the other existed. And it's just because the Indians here in the Chesapeake had seen the Spanish had come and just decide this wasn't worth conquering or even putting down anchor very much. And after the reports came back from the Caribbean, which actually, of course, was 100 years before, they were not surprised to find natives here. And so it's my understanding, Peter, that this is kind of a new frontier in history. We're realizing how much exchange there had been between Indians and Europeans before.
Tremendous amount of exchange. And, of course, white diseases moved into Indian country before whites themselves. The great smallpox epidemic of 1776, the mid-1770s, right at the time of the American Revolution, Plains Indians were dying in great numbers. And many of them had already domesticated the Spanish horses. So the horses were there, the pathogens were there, and the big fact of Indian life was rapid death, the decimation of Indian populations, perhaps by as much as 90%.
That's a great point, which suggests that the ultimate alien were these pathogens that simply did not exist in the New World and were brought in. So I think about De Soto coming here in the 16th century and leaving virtually no trace, but introduced the disease that decimated the Indians of the Southeast, so that when the English showed up, there had already been a great thinning out of the Indian population.
I think the connection between fear of foreigners and fear of diseases is very close. Often, foreigners are seen as vectors of disease. I mean, since the modern germ theory is not well known in the early period, people don't know exactly how diseases are introduced. But take the yellow fever, which destroyed populations in Philadelphia and other eastern ports in the mid-1790s. Where was that coming from? Seemed to be coming from the West Indies. Was it brought by slaves or by people who were escaping the Haitian Revolution? What was going on?
But you know what? In War of the Worlds, you know, the early 1950s movie, what is it that brings down the invaders?
I don't remember, actually.
They pick up an illness to which they did not have immunity. The humans are powerless in front of them, but the very same thing that had, in many ways, made it possible for Europeans to settle North America ended up saving the human race.
That's
against
a terrific
the Martians.
Point, Ed.
I haven't been that heavy since the dorm room in 1971. And just think how much we freak out with SARS and things like that, avian flu and all that. I think that this is still the ultimate fear because it is a completely portable alien.
Right.
You know, too small for the eye to see. So it's interesting how all these things are related, race, ethnicity, religion, and pathogens.
Yeah, look what you've done, Bill.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, we can fit horses in there. We've got the whole package.
Bill, thanks for that call. You provoked some very, very heavy thinking here on Backstory.
Well, you guys are some heavy thinkers, and I really appreciate that.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys.
The Martians had no resistance to the bacteria in our atmosphere to which we have long since become immune. Once they had breathed our air, germs, which no longer affect us, began to kill them. The end came swiftly. All over the world, their machines began to stop and fall. After all that men could do had failed, the Martians were destroyed and humanity was saved by the littlest things which God in his wisdom had put upon this earth.
That's it for today's show. Thanks for tuning in. Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner is our engineer.
Our theme music was composed by Gabby Alter. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Remember, we history guys are still figuring out what we're doing, and we'd love to get your thoughts about what we should be doing and how we're doing. There's an email form at our website, backstoryradio.org. Don't be shy.
We'll be back next week for more digging at the roots of the American past.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, and Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
And by Caroline Feeney, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J.M. Weinberg, Dr. Anna McGee, and an anonymous donor. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.